situation like a fire. Dad's got good instincts, though, so when he said he was suspicious, we went back in there. When we entered the room, he was about to add something to the IV bag with a syringe and startled when he spotted us. I knew that wasn't good. I told him to step away from the bag. Before I could get my gun, he pulled out one of his own. I wasn't sure if he was trying to scare us off or if he intended to shoot Libby. I gave the nurse's card a shove, and that banged into him. He fired a shot. I grabbed for him as I pushed Dad to the floor. I was off balance and went down too when the jerk slammed that table into me. Thanks a lot for knocking me to the floor like that, son.
Don didn't sound thankful.
We left the door to the room open behind us, so the perp scooted past us and out the door. He still had that gun, I guess, although he dropped the syringe. Someone called in the incident, and that code silver went out right away.
We sent a nurse to check on Libby, Frank said, picking up the story. Then we took off in pursuit of the gunman. Security was after him, too, by that point.
You guys either spotted that gun or were responding to the report of shots fired, Frank said, speaking to their supervisor. They were on the ball.
He must have been relieved to hear Frank say that, because he let out a big breath.
That guy with the gun was fast. He was down the stairs and out an emergency exit. The code was sounding, and more alarms were going off. Detective Hernandez, or someone else, can better describe what happened outside the hospital. We weren't far behind him, but by the time we got out the door, the perp had grabbed a car and taken off in it. There was already a police presence, I guess responding to the fire alarm. A couple patrol cars sped off after the shooter.
That's right, and a helicopter picked up the chase after that, Detective Hernandez said.
More police headed to the hospital as soon as the call went out that shots were fired. I talked to fire and rescue, and it was 2 or 3 minutes after the fire alarm went off that the first patrol cars arrived. The ones you saw, Frank. I got here a few minutes after that. I was already on the move when I got word that the trouble had started in the ICU and Ms. Huntington might be in danger. Several patrol cars gave chase, but the guy was moving fast. With the helicopter up, no way was he going to get away. The plan was to cut him off before he could get on the freeway. Then he blew a tire or hit something in the road and lost control. The car flipped over 2 or 3 times and then burst into flames, close to the intersection with Raymond Road.
It all happened fast, Chica. The news got out lickety-splickety,
Bernadette said, scooting closer to Jessica's bedside.
My phone was ringing and pinging. I knew it was too much of a coincidence that there was a fire at the hospital while you were here. I called Detective Hernandez and told him not to let some maliente get to you.
Bernadette knows all about my super powerful calamity magnetism, Jessica said to those in the room.
I didn't need Bernadette to tell me you might be in danger, Hernandez growled. As soon as Frank and Don Fontana realized the guy was after Libby, they called it in. When I called to check on you, I found out that the staff had seen 2 suspicious-looking guys, one oversized, in the corridor near your room, accompanied by a woman covered with strange tattoos.
One tattoo. And it's not strange, Kim said, despite her usual shyness, especially in a crowd. They were the first words she had uttered since they had all taken refuge in the bathroom. Hernandez ignored the comment.
I prefer to think of myself as right-sized, and Kim's tattoo is a work of art, Peter growled.
Yeah, that tattoo is righteous,
Brian added, to the annoyance of Detective Hernandez.
I guess I should have realized you were in no danger when they said one guy was eating. What kind of bad guys eat on their way to take out a target?
Detective Hernandez asked.
Speaking of eating, I'm hungry.
You guys hungry?
Brian asked. Not now, Brian, please, Jessica implored.
Anyway, when Frank and Don couldn't get you to answer the door, we all made a beeline for you. Since none of the members of your entourage wasted any time getting this place locked down, what do they know that we don't?
Hey, wait a second. We were just following hospital procedure, Laura responded. It was her turn to get annoyed.
And is it hospital procedure for Ms. Huntington to be throwing a party in her hospital room?
He asked, glowering at them.
It wasn't a party, or they would have invited Jerry and me, Tommy said. Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true. Jessica smiled feebly. Her head hurt again, as well as her ribs. She felt exhausted by all the turmoil and distressed by that attempt on Libby's life.
Look, I'd be happy to answer your questions, Detective Hernandez. I don't know what's going on any better than you do, but let's talk things over. Not now, but soon. I don't feel so well right now.
Nurse Andrews cut her off.
You don't feel well?
How could you? There's a reason we haven't been feeding you greasy burgers and fries
and coffee.
She tisk-tisked as she bent down and picked up the empty styrofoam coffee cup that had landed on the floor near Jessica's bed.
As soon as I get home and settled, I'll be happy to listen to all your questions. I'll even try to answer them. If you can figure out what's going on in the meantime, that's great. I'm not the least bit happy about the idea that somebody wants Libby dead. It can't be Carr, because he's already dead. My head hurts too much to think straight, much less figure any of this out.
Nurse Andrews, Doc, you all will send me home soon, right?
Nurse Andrews had that pressed lip thing going on. No way could any words escape the slash that passed for a mouth on her face. Jessica's doctor, who was still in the room, spoke up.
Barring any unforeseen developments, I expect to release you tomorrow, Jessica.
He spoke those words with a tone of relief, glad to be rid of her, no doubt. She found that irksome, but at least her attending physician addressed her by her first name.
Oh, that's wonderful news, Bernadette said, glaring at Nurse Andrews. We can take good care of you, and you won't have to starve. Peter and his guards will get back on the job so no guy can sneak in and shoot at you.
Yes, I agree. It is unacceptable that a gunman roaming the halls puts my daughter at risk, and you chew her out for eating a burger. Maybe we should take her out of here right now and move her to another hospital while she's still alive. You realize she's a lawyer, right? If she sues you for the trauma she's gone through today, I wouldn't blame her.
Jessica's mouth fell open as her mother spoke. Alexis was furious, her shoulders back, arms tight against her body, and fists clenched. Her mother's whole body shook.
You go, Mom, Jessica wanted to say, but didn't. Instead, she reached out and grasped her mother's hand. Alexis startled for a second at Jessica's touch. Recovering, she laced her fingers through her daughter's and returned Jessica's smile.
I don't think we need to do anything rash, Hank said.
The twinkle in his eyes betrayed the fact he was thoroughly enjoying Alexis's outburst.
However, Jessica's mother has made very good points. The Vanderwerts must have a lot of questions about how this happened, too, and I'm sure you'll have answers for all of us once you've completed a formal investigation. Why don't we clear out of here and let Jessica get some rest? It sounds like she will go home tomorrow, Alexis. I'm sure Nurse Andrews and the rest of the hospital staff are deeply embarrassed by the breach that occurred today, and will have someone apologize before they send her on her way. As for you, Detective Hernandez, I must ask you to use a more professional tone with my daughter.
Detective Hernandez, taken aback, was speechless. Another first for the day.
Aw, he doesn't mean nothing by it, Hank. That's just his tough cop talk. He likes Jessica.
A lot?
He's not so good at showing it.
Right, Detective? Bernadette asked. Hernandez wasn't just speechless, but he flushed bright red. Jessica couldn't tell whether that was from embarrassment or anger.
You'll hear from me day after tomorrow, Miss Huntington. Get settled in, because we need to have a long talk.
With that, he turned on his heels and marched out of the room. The rest of the crowd drifted away, with sorry tossed in here and there. Jessica doubted she would get anything like an official apology for the scare, at least not until the hospital's legal team had come up with wording that acknowledged the inconvenience without assuming responsibility for the incident. Nurse Andrews, the last of the staff members to leave, didn't say another word.
Frank, Uncle Don, thank you both. If you hadn't acted as you did, who knows what might have happened? To Libby or me?
Uncle Don moved close enough to Jessica to speak in a quiet voice.
We can't let anything happen to you. It would break this old man's heart, and I'd hate to think what it would do to my boy here.
Both father and son stood with matching expressions on their sweet faces.
She could see where Frank had inherited the tenderness that gave his brown eyes such depth.
I won't break your hearts. Promise.
As she spoke, Jessica prayed she could keep that promise.
12. An intervention. It wasn't clear who was happier about Jessica being released from the hospital. Jessica herself, her friends and family, or the hospital staff. After the incident with the gunman in the ICU, they beefed up security. The hospital authorities posted guards round the clock outside the rooms occupied by Jessica and Libby. That cost a bundle and couldn't have been reassuring to visitors who had family members or friends in nearby rooms. They let her go home Wednesday afternoon. Once she was home, Jessica felt much better. The beauty of the desert worked its magic as she reclined on a patio chaise. A gentle breeze swirled around her, carrying with it the sweet scent of jasmine. A light snow on the surrounding mountains glistened as the sun settled on their peaks, bathing the golf course in a golden, late-afternoon glow. Paradise beckoned, although something was up and nobody was talking. Jessica wished she had Bernadette's gift for picking up stray thoughts or making sense out of body language. There were more people in the house than there had been in months, and yet the silence was deafening. Bernadette scurried about. Her dad had a lap full of papers, and Alexis sat pretending to read a magazine. Her mother was thin and drawn, showing her age in a way Jessica hadn't noticed before. Alexis was distant, too, maybe preoccupied with the events of the past few days. Her fourth marriage is on the rocks, and her daughter has escaped death twice in the past week. What did I expect? She mused, as she eyed her mother, who smiled warmly.
I'm so glad you're okay, Alexis said, looking for a moment like she might cry. Then she seemed to fade away into her own world. Not long after, she excused herself and retreated to her wing of the estate. She left the magazine on the chair, as though she was coming right back. It was another déjà vu moment, as Jessica, Bernadette, and her father watched the woman drift off to the patio entrance that led back into her suite. Jessica caught a glance that passed between Bernadette and her father. Just like old times, Jessica thought, recalling how often a scene like this one had played out before her parents divorced. Perhaps it was the way her mother coped, divorcing everyone in her life for a time when she got rid of a husband. Jessica didn't understand or like it now any more than she had at 12.
I better check on dinner, Bernadette said.
She gave a nervous glance at the retreating figure of Jessica's mother before heading for the doors leading into the kitchen. The sound of the screen doors closing as Bernadette ducked inside echoed the sound made as her mother entered her suite. Hank stayed put. Their conversation was amiable, even though he remained distracted. That could have something to do with the number of projects he had going on and the backlog of tasks amassing, despite efforts to stay on top of the work from a distance. Jessica asked him to bring her up to date on his work. His enthusiasm grew as he spoke. Sitting with her father, talking about his work as an architect and developer, set off another round of been-there-done-that moments. As her mother withdrew, her father worked harder. Was that the pattern setting off eerie Twilight Zone music in her head?
I'm glad you're home, safe and sound, Jinx. Think you'll be okay if I head back to work tomorrow?
Sure. I've got Bernadette and Mom to help me. If they can't handle it, I can always call Laura or Tommy. So don't worry.
I am worried. What about that trouble at the hospital?
Peter's on top of it. We're covered round the clock. They won't let anyone get near me, even if they get through the gate. The police are on it, too. Detective Hernandez and his counterparts at the Palm Springs Police Department are as eager as we are to sort this out.
I'm sure you're right. I couldn't quite get what's up with that Hernandez guy.
Bernadette's got his number. He's a marshmallow covered in a crusty coating of grumpy cop. Sort of like Uncle Don, you know? We don't always see eye to eye, and I don't always like the way he expresses himself, but he's gruff because he cares. My track record for knowing when to cool it isn't that great. And I'm a sucker for incremental commitment. In for a penny, in for a pound. Before you know it, I'm in way over my head. The cops in my life keep me on a short leash, Dad.
I guess that's part of what I'm concerned about. You sure have had some close calls,
Maybe I should call and thank them for harping at you. I'm with them about cooling it.
Yeah, I know. But I hate it when something's going on and I can't figure out what it is. It's like an itch, and I get this compulsion to get to the bottom of it. I admit it. I stirred things up trying to find out who killed Roger Stone and Kelly Fontana.
Going after Libby in the hospital seems daring and desperate. Your detective friend implied you know more about this than you've said. Is that true? Are you keeping things from him?
Detective Hernandez always assumes the worst. The short answer is no. At least, I don't think so. I can't tell you all that's going on because I just don't know. We have been doing some investigating, just routine checks on Libby Vanderwerp and her shrink. She's in trouble that's somehow tied to her dead psychiatrist and a friend of hers who's missing. That's how Detective Hernandez got mixed up in this. He's looking for her missing friend. Maybe it will all make more sense after I've spoken to him. I owe statements to the Palm Springs police, too, but I've told Frank Fontana the whole story. I'm sure if he thought I had vital information that could solve the cases in Cathedral City or Palm Springs, his colleagues would have been at me already. For now, I'm out to sea with a boatload of puzzle pieces and no clear idea of the picture I'm trying to assemble. I'm not even sure I know what mysteries need to be solved. Why is everything always so complicated?
Hey, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be a lot richer than I am. You need to be careful until they figure this out. Libby's in deep trouble if someone wants her dead bad enough to go after her in the hospital in broad daylight. You may have some boundary issues dealing with other people's problems.
He wore that lopsided grin of his. A twinkle in his eye told her he was trying to make light of his concern. Oh, my God. Have you been watching Dr. Phil? Can't be Oprah. She's not on TV anymore.
What makes you think I haven't spent a little time of my own with a shrink? I'll have you know I've spent big bucks, just like you, to get better boundaries.
Even though he seemed to be taking what she said in stride, Jessica recognized worry when she saw it. Look, I'm working on it. Not just the boundary issue, but also a lot of other things. I'm always glad to see you and love hearing about your work, but you don't have to babysit me if you need to get back.
I still need more help to set limits. You get the incremental commitment problem from me, I'm afraid.
Hank let out a loud sigh.
Don't wait until you're as old as me to figure it out. When you're my age, it's not so easy to get caught up when things are backed up. I love you, and if you need me, I'll be here. Work be hanged. It will always take second place to you.
I know that. Thanks. Paul Worthington and Amy Klein have my back, but I'm dealing with the same issues about work on a much smaller scale. So I totally get it. The holidays are coming and I'm on the mend. Let's do something fun together, okay?
That's a great idea. Let's go to the Nutcracker or the Symphony for a Christmas concert or something here at the McCallum. I'll look for some dates for us. In the meantime, you promise to recover and stay out of trouble, okay?
Before she could answer, his cell phone rang. He took a quick look at the number.
I've got to take this, and I need some files I brought with me. Sorry, he said as he stood up,
planted a kiss on the top of her head, and moved inside the house. Their conversation had set off a surge of anxiety about her workload. Her job with the firm had taken off in the fall, almost as soon as the doors opened at the Palm Desert office. On Labor Day weekend, she and her mother had held a dinner party for the Vanderwerps. With her mother at the helm, the evening had been a delightful one. Cocktails and a dinner party had become a more elaborate affair than Jessica had envisioned, since there were several mutual friends and acquaintances in the area who knew both the Huntingtons and the Vanderwerps. Before she knew it, an intimate dinner had grown to include over 20 people. After that, Jessica's new practice had expanded fast, though. Most likely at her mother's urging, several dinner party guests had contacted or referred someone to Jessica for legal advice. Jessica fought off an image of her inbox overflowing with files stamped urgent in bright red letters. She should take that advice repeated by caring and concerned men in her life and have cool it emblazoned on a paperweight. Where were the boundaries on her work as a lawyer or between her problems and those that belonged to friends and family?
What was the name of that shrink her father had seen?
Jessica, Bernadette called out. Go tell your mom it's time to eat.
Okay. I can do it, her dad said, as he stepped to the patio door with an empty plate in his hand. No problem. My behind is falling asleep from all the time spent in a near-prone position. Go get your food. I'll get Mom, Jessica said, easing herself out of the chaise, which was much harder to do without the use of both arms.
Mom?
Jessica called out, tapping on the glass door.
Dinner's ready.
Jessica peered into the shadowy room. Her mother lay stretched out on her enormous bed. She looked so tiny. Was she struggling after finding herself sleeping alone again since her separation from Giovanni? After Jessica's own split with her husband, there had been a lot of sleepless nights. Online shopping binges with her black Amex card had been one strategy for filling the empty hours, provoked by the empty space in her bed.
Thanks. I'll be right there.
Another failed marriage couldn't be easy to handle. Giovanni had called, but her mother hadn't said a word about their conversation or why their marriage was over. Jessica wanted to ask, but felt constrained by her mother's evasiveness. Their relationship was often circumscribed by bonding rituals around shopping and spa visits, sharing food and wine, or a round of golf. She knew so little about her mother as a person or her experiences as a woman. Why was that? Maybe tomorrow I'll ask her point blank about Giovanni, Jessica thought, as she shuffled back to her seat on the patio, taking care not to jar her still sensitive ribs. Dinner was delicious. They ate red snapper, Vera Cruz style, according to Bernadette, accompanied by tiny roasted potatoes served alongside baby carrots tossed in a mango salsa. Alexis joined them, but said nothing as she picked at her food. She ate little, but refilled her wine glass several times. On the outside, quiet prevailed, although this dinner was supposed to be a homecoming of sorts. Inside, Jessica was growing more and more upset. It was good to be back in the lap of luxury and behind the gates at Mission Hills. With Peter and his guys back on duty sitting out in front of the house, she was safe for now, but not happy. What was getting to her was the undercurrent of a too familiar, yet mysterious, family dynamic. Her mother sat, tired, withdrawn, and a little shaky. Her father, worn out, but also wary and on edge, stole worried glances at Alexis. Even Bernadette grew quiet after a few attempts at conversation went nowhere. Another old feeling swept over her. Guilt. How much of all that worry and weariness is my fault? Jessica wondered. This time, it was no debacle ending in expulsion from private school, two in a matter of months, or a world-class tantrum that weighed them down. Instead, she'd been tossed off a mountain in a fracas with maniacs and might have been next in line for attack by that guy who shot his way out of the hospital. Were they sad, angry, or just too exhausted to speak? Her mind raced as the guilt hammered at her. The difference between the 34-year-old Jessica and the 14-year-old one was that she now knew she was no mind reader, nor was she willing to ignore the feelings that something was wrong.
Okay, you guys, what is going on? Are you all ticked at me?
Alexis looked up. If she was aiming to meet Jessica's gaze as she tried to feign wide-eyed innocence, it didn't work. She had to correct mid-course to make eye contact. As she did that, she slopped the contents of her wine glass on her white linen pants. She looked down and swiped at the damp spots on her lap.
Good thing it's a white wine, huh?
She asked, and then giggled. Jessica could see Alexis, the society darling mom, struggling to kick into gear, but with less skill than normal, or she might have missed it. It dawned on her how often her shapeshifter mother went from sullen social isolate to social butterfly when prodded or provoked.
No one's upset with you, Jessica. I'm not sure what's going on either. My guess is your mother is drinking too much. Again, I'd say she's well past tipsy.
Alexis tried to look offended, but once again, her gaze missed the mark. She had to readjust her line of sight to send daggers at Hank.
Mom, are you loaded?
Alexis did that morphing thing, and the anger toward Hank dissolved into society girl giggles that stopped when Hank spoke again.
I figure she's had a head start on the rest of us, or there's something extra in the mix. Am I right, Lexi?
His use of that pet name softened what was otherwise a harsh question. Jessica flashed on a glimpse she'd caught of the bedside table next to her mother. Pill bottles, several of them, were on that table, one with the lid off. She hadn't thought twice about it. Her mother always had pills around. Lots of them. Alexis had long been a hypochondriac, concerned about her own health and quick to run Jessica to a doctor, too. It had never occurred to her that all the pills might mean something else.
Besides boundaries, therapy has given me a better appreciation for directness. Consider this an invitation, Lexi. Not a well-planned one, and the timing may suck given Jessica's latest troubles, but enough is enough.
Bernadette spoke next, in a soft, firm tone.
The jig is out here, Alexis. Don't you agree? The goose is out of the barn, too. And you better spit out the beans.
No more tender voice had ever uttered such a garbled string of idioms. A pointed silence followed. Finally, Alexis spoke, misery on her face and in her voice.
Yes, I have a problem. More than one, in fact.
Alexis tried to steady her voice. Her eyes had filled with tears, and her lips trembled.
I'm sick.
13. French toast debrief. The next morning, Jessica took her time climbing out of bed. She was raw, mentally and physically. The impromptu intervention with her mother the night before had been revealing, but unnerving. Not only was her mother dealing with cancer, but alcohol and drug abuse. Learning that her mother had cervical cancer was bad. That she was putting off surgery because she didn't want to give up her pills and alcohol was terrifying and infuriating. She'd fought off the urge to take her mother by the shoulders and shake her. She wanted to shake her father, too, and even Bernadette for keeping so much hidden from her for so long. But with one arm in a sling and the other arm with a bandaged hand, she wasn't in any condition to shake anybody. What good would that have done anyway? She struggled to make sense of the new reality unveiled to her. Life as she knew it had changed in a matter of moments on that patio at dusk. Her mother had been forthcoming about the problem she faced, but her thinking was far from clear. Alexis knew she was in trouble. Still, she stunned Jessica when she hesitated about getting into treatment after admitting she needed it. She didn't balk, but wheedled, and attempted to stall.
I can't go. What about Giovanni?
Alexis asked.
What about him?
Bernadette countered.
He's not going anywhere, and you don't know for sure what you want to do about him, or you would have done it. Get yourself cleaned up, and what to do about Giovanni will become clear, too.
Alexis nodded, sniffling.
Jessica needs my help,
was another tack she had taken, to which Jessica had replied as fast as she could get the words out.
Mom, if you want the help, if you care about me, you'll get treatment now.
She tried to keep the anger out of her voice, without diminishing the urgency she intended to convey. Not just anger, but panic had set in, the panic she so often felt when forced to reason with the unreasonable. With a little more coaxing, Alexis agreed to get into treatment. Hank was on the phone immediately and found her a spot. Nothing was available at Betty Ford, so Alexis agreed to go to another classy rehab center, this one in Malibu. Jessica sat in silence, a stunned 12-year-old again, as the three adults acted. More than falling off a mountain, this long-held secret had knocked her flat on her back. Once her mother had gone to pack, it had taken Jessica half an hour to speak without anger, first to her father, then to Bernadette.
I don't understand. Why did you keep this part of our family life from me for so long?
There are so many reasons. I spent years in denial about your mother's problems. She was such a delight to have in my life so much of the time. Alexis was enchanting to be around, so full of energy and life.
Then this other side of her emerged soon after our marriage. She became moody and withdrawn at times. But who doesn't? At first, even that didn't set off any alerts. In time, things got worse. Still, she was such a good actress that if I said anything to her, she'd pull it together for a few days, and I'd think I was crazy. Did she have problems growing up? Grandma Emma always seemed happy to see us when we visited. Mom was a little quieter around her, but they seemed to get along. Emma and your mother were opposites. Emma was stern and so much more rigid and uptight than Alexis. She was critical of your mom, too. Her criticism seemed to be typical generation gap things, disputes about clothes and makeup, etiquette, all rather superficial. Maybe your mother took it to heart. I don't know. Did your mother ever complain about being whipped with hangers or other mommy dearest type moments? No. And Emma stayed out of our affairs once we married. We didn't visit often, but when we did, it was always tolerable.
What about her father?
Jessica was almost afraid to ask, given the horrid things that Libby and her doctor had cooked up to torment and extort her parents. It felt wrong to be asking such questions, like she was trying to pin the blame for her mother's problems on her grandparents. He was an affable guy. He drank a lot, but I never saw him drunk, if that's what you mean. The man always held a responsible position at work, and the community held him in high regard, so if he had a problem, he kept it hidden. I never asked Alexis any of these questions, so I don't know if there's a family history of alcohol or mental health problems. At some point, I became concerned about her mood swings and how much she was drinking, plus all the pills. When the news about Betty Ford's problems came out and she announced she was opening her clinic, I made a stab at getting Alexis to do something. She went into treatment and gave it all up right before she became pregnant with you. After your birth, she hung on for a while, but then slipped back into all the old patterns. She had an injury or two, or so she claimed, and the pills showed up again. I asked, but she told me to back off. She argued that doctors wouldn't give pills to her if she didn't need them. I'm not sure she ever stopped long enough to figure out if the booze and pills were the source of her problems, or if something else was going on. I felt confused and blamed myself. It was hard for me to gauge how much my work was impeding our relationship. At some point, my harping no longer seemed effective. I wasn't sure what to do, much less what to tell you. You were so young.
Did you know about this, Bernadette?
See, some of it. I did what I could to get Alexis to get help. It was hard to get the complete picture. I wondered about all the medicine she was taking, but like Hank says, she always had a reason. Headaches or back pain from falling off a horse or pulling something, playing golf or tennis. It was always something.
Bernadette shook her head, looking every bit her age.
I'm sorry I left, Hank said. But this went on for years, and I'd reached the end of my rope. The tension between us was causing you harm, and I figured that outweighed any good I could do. It's like I had become part of the problem rather than the solution. We separated for a while, and I hoped she'd come to her senses. You know, figure out which problems were because of me and which were her own. That didn't happen, so I gave up and agreed to a divorce. Eventually, she went into rehab again somewhere in Switzerland. Soon after, you went off to college in Irvine. Right, Bernadette?
Yeah. That helped some, too. She got herself cleaned up and was sober for a while, but the drogado wasn't the only devil in her life. I don't think she's faced up to all of them yet.
Isn't Switzerland where she met that Cranston guy? Jessica asked.
That's right. She was feeling better after the treatment. Then she met Cranston, fell in love, and married him in no time at all.
Too fast, I thought. But what could I do? Bernadette said. We had lived apart for years, but I was heartbroken. But when I saw her again after that, it was a relief to see her happy, so I hoped he'd succeed where I had failed. He turned out to be not so good for her. Soon she was back on the party wagon. On the wagon, off the wagon. I forget which is which when it means she's doing good or not so good. When she wasn't around much, it was even harder to tell what was going on. One day, Cranston's gone and another guy's there. Was that a good sign or bad?
I don't know for sure.
I hated being kept in the dark. The undercurrents made me crazy. I thought it was my fault that our family fell apart.
When you were young, we all told you it wasn't your fault. Later, when you became an adult, you were so busy making a life for yourself. College and law school, and gym and the bar test. With a job and a wedding and the house fixing, what could you do about your mother's life?
Bernadette's right. By that point, your mother was my ex-wife. What she did wasn't my business anymore, unless it had to do with you.
It was so confusing. I knew things weren't right. There was so much I didn't understand.
You were a child then. I wasn't sure what was going on with your mom either. We did what we could to reassure you we both loved you, even if we couldn't work things out between us. That wasn't always easy, given the way you acted out, I might add.
I know, Dad. I feel guilty about that, too.
I don't want you to feel guilty. All I'm saying is that we all did the best we could. Now that you've divorced Jim, it must have crossed your mind that if you had kids, things would be even more complicated than they are. You'd have difficult choices to make, deciding how much to say to your child about Jim's behavior and the problems in your marriage. I didn't want my disappointment to turn you against your mother. It wasn't Bernadette's place to tell you more than I did. I just kept most of what was going on, or what I assumed was going on, to myself. All I could do was to tell you, repeatedly, that your mother and I never stopped loving you, even when we couldn't be together anymore.
I am grateful for that. You're right. I have given a lot of thought to how much more difficult divorce would have been if Jim and I had a child. Having to be in the same room with him still seems like more than I can bear. So thanks for figuring out how to make that work with Mom.
It was hard at first, but my relationship with your mother improved, especially when she was sober. I can't tell you for sure how I know that. There's just something different about her when she's sober and when she's not. It's clear she hasn't won whatever fight she's been waging to achieve sobriety. Given the way all the old patterns reappear, I'm with Bernadette that Alexis hasn't faced down the demons that bedevil and beguile her.
Jessica was curious and wanted to hear more about those demons, but an interruption ended their conversation.
Well, if you all are through psychoanalyzing me, I'm packed, demons and all.
Her mother stood in the doorway, lit from behind. A strange halo illuminated her as she spoke. A rush of emotions overtook Jessica. Anger and fear supplanted by sorrow and even pity for this woman she loved. All those years of her mother's life spent in turmoil. Jessica felt crushed by the waste of it all, the loss of what might have been. Now Alexis was sick with cancer, too. At least there was still time for her mother to sort things out. In a split second, Jessica was at her mother's side, pulling her as close as a one-armed woman with battered, sore ribs could. Her mother clung to her as best she could without causing Jessica more pain. They wept for several minutes.
I love you. Please do what they tell you so we can be a family. I'll try not to expect perfect. Even if it's a little screwed up, that's okay. I'll take what I can get. You, Dad, Bernadette, and me. But please, Mom, you've got to keep fighting to stay alive. Get clean enough to have that surgery soon, okay?
Alexis nodded her head yes.
I'll try, baby girl. Promise.
Jessica didn't object to the baby girl name that so often chafed when her mother used it. She would answer to any name her mother called her if it meant they could have a future together. Jessica covered her mother's face with kisses before releasing her. Hank put his hand around Alexis's shoulders, picked up the bag she had with her, and escorted her to a car that was waiting for them. The car would take them to Jackie Cochran Airport, a few miles away, where Hank had arranged for a helicopter service to pick them up. They were taking her straight to the facility in Malibu and admitting her that night, leaving no chance for Alexis to change her mind. It would be at least a couple days before Alexis would be allowed to have contact with family. Jessica planned to make her way to Malibu to see her mother in a few days. Check on her. Or maybe check up on her. She wouldn't be remiss again and would wield her powers of hypervigilance, at least until her mother got that surgery. They'd have to run more tests at that point to figure out if Alexis would need chemo
and she'd stand watch then, too. By the time she and Bernadette said goodnight, a little while later, Jessica felt exhausted. She wanted to indulge in a bout of anxiety-driven information gathering and read everything she could find on the web about early-stage cervical cancer. Instead, she had fallen asleep. As she slouched her way down the hall the next morning, the house felt too big, empty, now that both her mother and father had left. She could hear noises coming from the kitchen as she got closer. Smelled delightful aromas, too.
Coffee. I smell coffee. It's making me dizzy.
Sit down and I'll bring you... Jessica, you're still in your clothes from last night. Bernadette stopped, dead in her tracks, with a large mug of coffee in her hand. Jessica's mouth watered at the sight.
I know. I meant to change. I climbed into my bed with my laptop and passed out.
Trust me, it wasn't because of any drugs either. I took one of the co-Tylenol they prescribed, but I am spooked about taking anything more than a couple of aspirin today. A little pain seems a small price to pay for keeping your wits about you. I don't care what Dad says. Drug and alcohol problems run in families. And speaking of drugs, once I get caffeine into my system, I'll go clean myself up and put on different clothes. She winced as she sat down at the table in the morning room off the kitchen. Even ordinary movements jarred her ribs.
Not taking drugs is a good idea, but I heard them tell you not to let the pain get so bad you breathe funny and get your lungs in a mess. You made a face when you sat down.
I saw that.
I am sore, but so far I can take it. The aspirin should help soon.
Bernadette set the mug of coffee down in front of Jessica. The bandage on her hand was smaller than the first one put on in the ER, but she still found it awkward. One-handed, she had to be careful with hot coffee, despite her eagerness to scarf it down.
You ask the doctor about it when you go for your checkup this afternoon, okay?
Sure, if you think I should. I'll take an ice pack and use it when I go back in my room. That helps, too.
Oh, my God, this coffee is wonderful. I love you.
Aw, I'm glad you're not still mad at me about not telling you more about what was going on with your parents.
Gracias a Dios. This is all out now, though.
Bernadette crossed herself as she spoke those last words. I was more shocked than angry. If I'm angry with anyone, it's Mom. Not just because she's been hiding a drug problem from me for years, but she's also chosen her drugs over getting treatment for cancer. I'm sure she's telling us the truth that her prognosis is good, but not if she keeps putting off surgery. I'm going to read about it today, but I'm pretty sure if she can get through detox, she can also go ahead with surgery. Now there's a sentence coming out of my mouth that I never expected to utter. You never know what's coming next, do you?
Another cup of coffee is what's next for you, chica. I fixed it just the way you like it. In the French press, steeping for 10 minutes after grinding the beans. I like that part of it now, too. They smell so good. I get that connect high, like the drug takers talk about.
Do you mean a contact high? Where on earth did you hear that?
One of those true crime shows. Or maybe it was in a story about Charlie Sheen or Robert Downey Jr. They've been to rehab too, you know. I hope it works better for your mom than it has for Charlie.
Bernadette turned around, shaking her head as she headed back into the kitchen. Well, Robert Downey Jr. seems to have pulled out of the tailspin his life was in. I thought he was a goner after they found him in a stranger's house out here in the desert.
I think he spent some time at the same place Hank took your mom. It must be a good place.
Yeah, and I suppose it takes more than one try at treatment for addicts to recover. Jessica caught her breath again, from the pain in her heart, not her ribs. Her beautiful, vivacious mother was an addict. How impossible was that to believe?
The world has gone mad. My husband, a cheating fool, marries a crazed, out-of-control, massively pregnant exhibitionist.
Laura's husband gets himself murdered, and Kelly Fontana, too. She was pumped full of drugs but wasn't an addict, and Mom is. Go figure.
It'll be okay. You'll see. You fell off a mountain and you're okay. Maybe that was a shake-up your mother needed to make her face her troubles. The whole family here together at once was a good thing.
you and your dad speaking up at the same time was a good thing, too.
Yeah, that's all true. You didn't back down either, even when she tried to use Giovanni and me as reasons to put off treatment. A lot of things that went on when I was a kid make so much more sense now. I hear what you're saying. Good things can come from bad situations.
Speaking of good things,
Bernadette hustled into the kitchen and came right back. French toast. You made me French toast. My favorite. Did I already say I love you? The luscious scent of maple and cinnamon reached her even before Bernadette set the plate down in front of her. She dug in, one-arm style, savoring the ambrosial, melt-in-your-mouth blend of flavors. Bernadette sat down across from her with a plate of her own. Then she slid a card toward Jessica. Pausing for a moment, Jessica put the fork down and picked up the card.
Oh, my God. It's your recipe.
Shock must have been on her face. You're not sick, too, are you?
No. But now you're grown and around here all the time, you need to figure out how to fix your favorites.
Bernadette chuckled.
Close your mouth and finish your breakfast.
She shook her head, still smiling. Well, I can't shut my mouth and eat, can I? Jessica paused, torn between devouring the food on her plates and reading the secret ingredients revealed in that recipe. French toast, accompanied by thin slices of a salty Spanish ham and fresh raspberries, won out. They spent a blissful half hour eating and drinking coffee. She read the ingredients and the instruction for preparing St. Bernadette's Divine French Toast, as Jessica had named it. Bernadette provided a step-by-step commentary as Jessica read the list of ingredients. Thick slices of brioche soaked in eggs, sugar, and cream, spiked with brandy and fresh-squeezed orange juice, Mexican cinnamon, and Mexican vanilla. No wonder Jessica's previous attempts had fallen short. The last instruction on the card was the most touching, another of Bernadette's secrets revealed.
Never forget to prepare and serve with love. Ay, que bueno.
How could so much goodness be packed into that small, precious being sitting across from her at the table? Bernadette, as Jessica knew, had experienced her share of hardship and loss.
I don't know what I would have done without you all these years. Still don't. Mom and I wouldn't have gotten this far. I am so grateful.
Aw, that's just a French toast talking, Bernadette said with a big grin on her face.
Her eyes were a little misty, though.
It's been a blessing for me, too. Families always have troubles, and taking care of each other is just what they ought to do.
Most aren't as lucky as I am, though, and I never want to take the good in my life for granted.
That's a good practice. To be grateful. Let me know when you want to get ready so you won't be late for your doctor appointment this afternoon. I'll drive you.
Okay. I'm not up to driving yet, that's for sure. Who knows what other hurdles I'll face trying to get around in my current condition. I'm slow, but I'm getting the hang of doing some things with one arm. Keeping my cast and bandages dry with a plastic bag is a trick I learned when I sprained my wrist, so I can manage a shower. The things I've added to my skill set this past year. I can get the sling off, but I might need your help putting it back on.
Just holler when you're ready to do that. How about your hair?
It's grown out a lot. I can at least give you a hand with the blow dryer when you get that far. I'm sure the doctor won't care if I show up with my hair hanging in my face. Maybe I should get it cut again, even shorter this time. I appreciate your going with me. I could have one of Peter's men do that, but I'd rather have you with me. We still don't know what's going on with that attack on Libby in the hospital. I don't know if I'm a target, too, and I'm in no shape to find out the hard way.
Have one of those guys come with us, too. I can drive, but you should have someone come along behind us to keep an eye out for Malientes.
You're right. That's the first thing I'll do when I get back to my room. Give Peter a call. I should also call my office and check in with Amy. There's plenty more to do if I can get myself organized.
Don't put too much on that to-do list of yours. You're a tough nut to crumble, but not Superwoman.
Cookie, Bernadette. I think you mean I'm a tough cookie, or a tough nut to crack. That's the way the cookie crumbles.
Correcting Bernadette's misuse of idioms was a habit she needed to break. It wasn't necessary, nor would it work. It annoyed most people when she corrected their misstatements, her perfectionism oozing out like a leaky faucet, even when she thought she had shut it off.
Cookie, that too, Jessica. You don't crumble easily. You get my drift, right?
Sure, I get your drift. Bernadette was smiling, and Jessica wondered if Bernadette was toying with her, playing with words to lighten things up. She downed the last sip of coffee and stood up, carefully, waiting for the pain to register. Not bad. The aspirin must have kicked in. If I get stuck trying to get ready, I'll yell for help. Promise.
Okay, mi dulce princesa,
Bernadette said. Hopped up on caffeine and loaded on a breakfast made in heaven by an angel here on earth, Jessica felt almost normal. Well, as normal as possible in the current context. She basked in the glow of secrets revealed. It wasn't just that recipe from Bernadette. As tough as it was to face her mother's situation, it was better than not knowing half-truths or believing lies. Having it all out in the open satisfied some inner longing, truth revealed, a mystery solved, or at least on the way to being solved. She'd know more after she read up, not just about cervical cancer, but also alcohol and drug problems. She'd call Laura later, too, and drill her about both kinds of health problems. Given her nurse's training, she'd know how best to support her mother. Maybe she would quiz Betsy Stark about the drug issue, too, when she came by the house tomorrow. That she was meeting with Betsy reminded her that she had a huge set of issues to deal with, besides those having to do with her own family. There were all those other mysteries hanging out there for another family. She felt more keenly aware of how much damage family members could do to each other, accidentally or on purpose. What was going on with Libby? Where was her friend Shannon Donnelly? With Dr. Richard Carr dead, who was after Libby? Was Jessica's life on the line? Why? 14. First Contact. When Jessica returned to her room, the first item of business was where to sit to get work done. Those ribs were still giving her grief, so she opted to get back into bed. That could be risky, given her general state of exhaustion, warring with the caffeine and sugar she'd just consumed. In bed, she propped herself up at the best angle to work with the least amount of pain, surrounded by things she needed. Her phone, her laptop, and several file folders with photos, police reports, and printed copies of information Tommy and Jerry had produced for her about Libby Vanderwert and Dr. Richard Carr. Jessica picked up the Vanderwert's folder. It seemed like years instead of months had passed since they hired her to put their estate plans in order. Retirement loomed, and they had wanted a plan in place for the long haul. That included a modest allowance for their daughter, who seemed unable to provide for herself. But by the time Jessica got down to the business of figuring out how much of their assets to put into trust for Libby, the ground had shifted. They moved up their retirement date and took Paul's advice to set up a trust to protect their assets from their daughter's aberrant behavior, rather than simply making provisions for her. She picked up Libby's file next. The sordid details of the young woman's life, spelled out in the pages of that file, pushed Jessica toward that pit of despair she felt about wasted lives. Libby's youth seemed spent using every advantage she possessed to destroy herself and others. Jessica's first face-to-face encounter with Libby had occurred when the young woman showed up one day at the Palm Desert Law Office. Libby waltzed in without an appointment and demanded to see Jessica. Jessica agreed to meet with the rude, noisy young woman from both curiosity and the need to preserve decorum. Kim Reed had spoken up as Libby Vanderwert followed Jessica down the hall to her office. "I'll be right with you as soon as I get what I need to record the interview." Libby stopped, as if to balk, and turned to confront Kim. Much to her surprise, Kim was close. So close, Libby almost bumped into her. The steely determination in Kim's dark eyes, her edgy dress, and no-nonsense demeanor must have convinced Libby to abort any form of protest she was considering. "Whatever." Libby shrugged and moved to the door Jessica had just walked through. Jessica's office was roomy, with large windows that overlooked the parking lot that served their building and the nearby shops. Beyond the parking lot and busy streets was a view of the mountains, towering palm trees, and those blazing blue skies that dominated the Coachella Valley. Jessica had seated them at a small conference table, and then took control of the conversation.
"Okay, Ms. Vanderwerf, how may I help you?"
"Oh, my God. You are exactly what I expected. I heard my parents hired a gorgeous young female lawyer. You'll make Dad look less like scum standing next to him if I have to take him to court." She smiled in a crooked way, tilting her head to one side like a hawk sizing up its prey. Jessica had seen that look before. A tingle of recognition danced its way down her spine as she remembered her encounters with the diabolical Marguerite during the investigation into Roger Stone's murder.
"My shrink says you have a soft spot for the bastard. Anybody who sides with my dad must have a daddy thing going on."
"He's right, Miss Huntington. You look like a daddy's girl."
"You must know I can't talk to you about your father or my role as his lawyer. So how may I help you?"
"Help me? You're the last person in the world who can help me.
I don't get it. How can you all be representing Dad? You used to be my lawyer. Isn't that a conflict of interest or something like that?"
The predatory look on her face had vanished, and in its place was a pouty 10-year-old girl. Her bottom lip poked out, and she twisted a strand of hair around her finger as her eyes grew misty.
"I've never been your lawyer, Ms. Vanderwerf. I..."
Before Jessica could finish, the disturbed young woman interrupted.
"Cut the Ms. Vanderwerf routine already. It makes me feel ancient, like you're talking to my mother. It's Libby, okay?"
Pouting had morphed into surliness.
"Sure, Libby, but as I was saying, I have never been your lawyer. Just because the firm in L.A. defended you in a previous case doesn't mean I'm under any obligation to represent you or to turn down your parents' request for help. From what I hear, you have your own lawyer with another firm. You need to take up whatever concerns you have with him."
Paul Worthington, Jessica's boss, had honchoed the case in which the firm defended Libby from charges related to a drunk driving incident that killed Libby's friend Leela. Leela Vasquez had been as drunk and stoned as Libby was that night. Libby was at the wheel at the time of the accident, in part because the police had stopped them earlier that night when Leela was driving recklessly. Rather than taking them both into custody, the officer had given them a warning and let them go. When the crash occurred later, Libby was at the wheel. It wasn't her first incident involving drunk driving, but the law firm was able to keep records of earlier incidents out of the court because she was underage when they occurred. She took a deep breath, waiting for Libby to reply. She didn't break eye contact and took her own turn sizing up the adversary in her midst. On the surface, the woman looked credible, but she'd learned that was not at all unusual for your garden variety sociopath. They were often good at faking it, passing as a normal person with a conscience. For short periods, anyway. Libby had garnered a host of diagnoses over the years, having been in and out of treatment since the age of 12. Conduct disorder, ADHD, and depression as a teen. Borderline and bipolar disorders were added to the list, along with substance abuse problems when she was a young adult. She struggled to remember if Libby's parents had mentioned sociopath, antisocial something or other, maybe. Libby had been in treatment since the deadly auto accident, as mandated by a probation agreement, and she'd changed shrinks several times. Treatment included an assortment of prescribed drugs, but those weren't the only substances she used. Her history of drug use, revealed during the investigation into that late-night single car crash, was distressing. That she hadn't died from an overdose, remarkable. Jessica wondered how many of the drugs on that list were used by her mother. Why hadn't she asked? Jessica refocused on Libby's file. The most recent communications about Libby's mental health status involved a new diagnosis: PTSD from sexual abuse, allegedly experienced at the hands of her father and uncle. That information had been conveyed to her parents by Libby, by Dr. Carr, and in sloppy, typewritten threats on letterhead from a series of schlock lawyers Libby had hired. She threatened to sue her parents if they didn't fork over her inheritance.
That new diagnosis must have meant new drugs, too, she muttered, poring over the file again for information about prescribed drugs. Some familiar names popped up. Others were new. Adderall, Zoloft, Celexa,